Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
We engaged seriously, and as we speak now, the agreement to restructure with official creditors, China, India, and so forth, that is done. The agreement, the bondholders, we've agreed in principle, is now processes that are ongoing now.
Zambia's finance minister expresses confidence debt restructuring talks with both local and international partners will be complete this year.
We are doing this as SADC because we recognize that the price of losing peace is much more than really trying to bring it back together. And this has been a hallmark as a region to make sure that we maintain peace and security. So we've put in these two missions to make sure that we're able to support, but also to protect the region at a larger level.
The executive secretary of SADC commits to ensuring peace and political stability in all member states.
It's a big dilemma even for humanitarian organizations how to intervene, because sometimes when you intervene with food aid that never gets to the people, you're actually feeding the armies, which is actually making the problem bigger. So Ethiopia is in its own difficult dilemma and crisis.
And Ethiopia is facing one of the worst droughts in recent history as millions of its people suffer from acute hunger. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Zambia's finance minister is expressing confidence that before the end of the year, the administration in Lusaka would have completed debt restructuring talks with both local and international partners. Situmbeko Musokotwali says restructuring the country's debt is necessary to reduce the financial burden on citizens and prevent the government from creating an enabling environment for investment, social interventions, and the creation of jobs for youth to reduce unemployment. The Zambian finance minister is in Washington to attend the spring meetings of the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, and the World Bank. I had sat down with Situmbeko Musokotwani for an interview. Topics covered include the latest development on Zambia's debt restructuring talks and its government economic transformation drive. Here is part one of the conversation.
2.5 years ago, when the current administration got into office, Zambia had defaulted with international creditors. It was a difficult situation. So to get rid of this problem, of the stigma of a defaulting countries where investors are shunning, we engaged seriously. And as we speak now, the agreement to restructure with official creditors, China, India, and so forth, that is done. The agreement with the bondholders, we have agreed in principle, is now processes that are ongoing now to get that to be put in black and white. So the official and the bondholders together constitute about 75% of the debt that is required to be structured. Done. 25%, as I said, with the commercial banks. Discussions are going on right now also to restructure that. So hopefully, not hopefully, but certainly within this year, all the various creditors would have discussed with them.
Dr. Musokotwali, I understand you talked last time when you came here about Zambia's economic transformation. Where is it at the moment? And is there a role for the international community to help with your efforts or the government's efforts in Lusaka?
There is a big role, and this is connected to the debt restructuring. We realize that debt restructuring alone, it gives us relief, as I've described. But the young people in Africa, Zambia, Ghana, Kenya, and so forth, they are looking for better livelihoods. Better livelihoods by having jobs that are decent, well-paying, and so forth. With debt restructuring, investor confidence is coming back. They are coming to do the investment. So you're asking the question, the role of the international community. We say to them, you want to do something about cooling the earth so that kind of a heat because of climate change. For that, you need materials that we in Zambia have. You need copper, we have it. You need cobalt, We have it. You need manganese, nickel, we have them. Come and invest. Because as you invest, yes, you make your profits, and we have no problem with that, but you create the jobs, and we'll also be able to pay taxes that we need to provide services to our people.
Recently, there have been concerns about high inflation. The country staple, the mealie meal, appeared to be expensive now. That's what some of the critics are saying. So how are you handling this as a finance minister and as a government? How are you handling this? What assurances are you giving the people that, indeed, we know things are difficult, but these are the steps we are taking to address some of these challenges? How do you address them?
Private companies, private individuals from these neighboring countries, they came in, bought the maize, and of course, as they bought the maize, the prices went up. For the farmers, our farmers, it was very good. But obviously for the urban people who cannot cultivate for themselves, they saw the prices going up. So arising from that, out of the realization that we can no longer consider ourselves just to produce for ourselves, but we have to be part of a regional bloc. Last year, the government made tremendous efforts to encourage production of maize. We encouraged banks to give loans to farmers. They did. Government itself put money aside so we have to feed the people. So we are readjusting our budget, cutting off or deleting some of the programs that we had so that the money can be available to feed the people. Number two, we still need farmers because next year it may rain properly. But if the farmers have been wiped out, we'll have rain but no food. So we are urging banks to restructure the debts of the farmers. Like the way the international community has restructured our debts, we tell the banks, please, let's work together to restructure.
How are the banks responding?
They will respond positively.
Situmbeko Mosokotwane is Zambia's finance minister. He spoke with me from here in Washington. Join us on Sunday for the conclusion of the conversation. Still in Zambia, President Hakainde Hichilema is appealing to the international community to send financial support to his drought-stricken country. Adversely affected by the ongoing drought, the president said Zambia needs about $940 million to help at least half of the population who is in need of urgent humanitarian assistance. According to official figures, out of the 9.8 million affected by the drought, at least 6.6 million need urgent relief, including for food and recovery needs. For more on the president's appeal, I reached Information Minister and Chief Government Spokesperson Cornelius Muitua.
The areas that have been hit by this drought, it has affected the production of food, particularly the staple food, which is maize. I know maize, that's where we do the mealie meal for our staple food as a country and the region. Number two, we have a situation where production of hydroelectricity has been challenged because of this meteorological drought, which has left a situation where most of our dam reservoirs have collected water at low levels, that the production of electricity has been affected. And of course, number three, we do have a situation where as a result of this drought, we do expect animal disease to be of concern in the country. So those are the major areas which have, resulted as a result of this drought, and particularly to do with the food shortage challenges. That is the main one.
It's understood that nearly half of Zambia's population has been affected by the drought, with the country needing about $940 million in aid to cushion the effect of this. How true is this, and how does the government plan if the international aid or donor agencies are able to provide this amount? How does the government plan to utilize this?
Well, first of all, this is a government of prudence, proven prudent management of national resources. And this can be seen from the fact that for the very first time in more than a decade, Zambia has recorded progress on the Transparency International Corruption Perception Index, which really gives a mirror image of how government is handling and managing and utilizing public, you know, resources, particularly funds. Therefore, with that kind of situation, the international community, including local donors, are rest assured that whatever level of support they are going to render, land in very safe and capable hands, as has already been demonstrated in line with what the president had promised the people before he became president, that once he gets to that saddle of authority, he will ensure he fights abuse of public resources to the core, to fight corruption and the plunder of national resources. That is exactly what the president is doing, anchoring, of course, on the rule of law.
Mr. Mwitwa, how does the government plan to implement measures to combat some of these issues of food insecurity, particularly when it comes to the issues of drought in the future? I'm talking about measures the government plans to implement to prevent such, you know, dire situation in the future.
Well, thank you very much. You know what the president had done with his administration, first of all, was to beginning to graduate the country ahead of this, actually, the disaster, before this drought could be foreseen, by beginning to promote irrigation of maize. Firstly, the president and his administration decided to tackle this situation, number one, by making growing of maize an attractive venture, like I've indicated, to increase the price, of maize and make it an attractive and viable commercial endeavor. Number two, the president began to prepare the nation to graduate from monopoly of dependency on rain-fed agriculture and begin to introduce irrigation agriculture. And therefore, last year, the president had a meeting with commercial farmers who had, many of them had abandoned the production of maize. He had a meeting with them and agreed that they return back to production of maize on contract farming basis. And they had to start with what we're calling early maize, meaning that even before the rainy season could start, the commercial farmers, using their irrigation logistics, began to grow that maize with anticipation that when the rain comes, it takes, part of the watering of that maize to ease the cost of production. And that maize, sometime, I think some 4-5 weeks ago or 6 weeks ago, the president, had gone to begin to commission the harvest of that maize.
Cornelius Mwitwa is Zambia's Information Minister and Chief Government Spokesperson. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. The Executive Secretary of the Southern African Development Community, or SADC, says the regional bloc is committed to ensuring peace and political stability in all of its member countries. Elias Magusi says he is working to implement measures to combat food insecurity following the recent drought that has adversely affected member countries. Magusi also tells VOA that SADC is working with international partners to soon launch a regional humanitarian appeal due to the ongoing drought. SADC is also working to consolidate peace and security in the DRC, Mozambique, and to continue progress made in resolving the political issues in Lesotho and Eswatini, as well as the upcoming elections in 6 member states. I sat down with SADC Executive Secretary Elias Magusi. Here is part one of the conversation.
Mozambique trying to deal with matters of terrorism, and we needed to support the country to make sure that it does not fester into the other parts of the region. And in DRC is to support the DRC, particularly the eastern part, to make sure that they are able to provide security of the citizens and then make sure that we allow for humanitarian activities to take place. So the government of DRC asked us to support as SADC. We are doing this as SADC because we recognize that the price of losing peace is much more than really trying to bring it back together. And this has been our hallmark as a region to make sure that we maintain peace and security. So we've put in these two missions to make sure that we're able to support, but also to protect the region at a larger level. Obviously, these are not cheap undertakings. They take a lot of our resources. We've lost lives as well in terms of our troops on the ground, but we believe it's a sacrifice that is worth taking, given the much bigger price we might pay if we didn't take these steps. In Mozambique now, we believe we've done enough ground, and we are now exiting. The Member States Summit has made a decision for us to exit. By July 15th, we should be out, and Mozambique now has given us assurance, President Nyusi, that they are now ready to support this process beyond our mission.
Let's look at a country or the kingdom of Eswatini.
Yes.
I know SADC has called for a national dialogue.
Yes.
Opponents of the administration appear not to be too pleased with what they say is a lack of pressure to ensure that this holistic or genuine dialogue happens to ease the political tension in the country. What is the effort to have this achieved?
Yes. For Eswatini, a decision was made that there needs to be a national dialogue process. And this was at the instance of SADC itself, recognizing that there could be differences of understanding between the different players and the government of the day, or the kingdom as it were. Now, we've had these iterations between ourselves and the kingdom, but I think in the last summit, which was last year, just before they went into elections in August, the Kim Swati came to summit and said, you know what, we feel where we are now, we're in a safer space than we were in August of 2023 when we were in Kinshasa, which raised a lot of concerns, and he was pleading to the region to support. He felt last year, August, that they are in a safer place and that they should be allowed to deal with matters internally. And they will now, even beyond the elections, now perhaps consider starting the process of national dialogue. We are still interested as SADC to make sure that the national dialogue process continues. Those recommendations include what they ought to do, including this particular item on national dialogue. And we've engaged with others, the EU, the UNDP, and other international partners who are also supportive of this process, that ultimately the kingdom should engage, as Lesotho did, engage in national dialogue to find a common position for everybody else.
You have top elections coming up.
Yes.
Botswana, where your headquarters is, of course, the powerful South Africa, is also having its national elections. What role will SADC play? I know usually you send poll observers to monitor the elections. What other effort or support will you give to these countries who are organizing elections this year?
Again, drawing from our instruments coming out of the organ, you will understand that it's not the first time that we'll be observing elections. SADC sends out a SADC election observer mission. But before it, there is a very important structure that goes in. This is a structure called the SADC Electoral Advisory Council, and it's made up of judges from the region who go in, assess a country, like you gave example of Botswana. They'll go into Botswana and assess the environment, the political, and they'll talk to all stakeholders. We are not dependent on the member state defining to us who we should meet. No, we decide, and the judges do that. We also look at the past reports where we had last elections for Botswana. It was 2019. So we look at the report and say, what have they done in terms of the recommendations that SADC made? So based on that and the environment on the ground, the SIAC produces this report and they advise the chairperson. In this case, this is Zambia today, President Hichilema. We think we should go in. The country is ready that it can hold election, or we can send in a mission into that. So we observe. We look at three instruments, which is the constitution of the country, the electoral laws of the country, and our own guidelines that determine how elections ought to be run. And based on that, based on the elections, and the observation is done by member states themselves, and then we produce a report which then is shared with the country and other stakeholders as well. So this has sustained us for quite some time, and we use it continually. for that. But we urge member states. We don't come with a carrot and stick. We will kindly urge a member state like Botswana, please make sure you implement some of these reforms.
Elias Magusi is the Executive Secretary of the Southern African Development Community, or SADC. He spoke with me from here in Washington. Join us on Sunday for the conclusion of the conversation. Political analysts say a decision to expel former South African President Jacob Zuma from the ruling African National Congress Party, or ANC, can significantly damage its prospects in the coming general election. This after they say the ANC appears indecisive on whether Zuma remains a member of the party 3 months after his suspension. The party temporarily suspended the former president after he vowed to vote for the newly formed Nkonto Wesizwe, or MK party, in the coming May national elections. Franz Kronje is a political analyst and the chairman of the Social Research Foundation. He tells me that the rise of the newly formed and Zuma-led Nkonto Wesizwe party is taking away some support from the ANC in the run-up to next month's national polls.
Mr. Zuma is an immensely popular political character in many important South African constituencies. And the ANC therefore has a particular problem now. If it in fact carries through an action such as a suspension or expulsion, it will further bolster his reputation, because lots of that reputation rides on the idea that he is an alienated and abused former leader of the ANC, abandoned by an ANC that has become distant and aloof. And that resonates deeply with a lot of ordinary voters.
So, France, you think this is a headache for the ANC itself, because they suggested that there was no need to expel him because he was campaigning for another party, which means he has expelled himself. However, President Zuma said he will remain within the AMC, although he would vote for the Nkonto Wesizwe party, and now he has been made the face of the party.
Yeah, well, he's certainly identified in public in South Africa and in the media as the leader, which is what he is, of the Mkhonto Wesizwe party. And it is that party that has driven the ANC's support level so far below 50% over the past 6 months. But I think the problem you point to, and the sort of incoherent approach to him from his, well, you couldn't say his erstwhile party colleagues, he's still a member of the party, is a function of a much deeper malaise, of the consequences of more than a decade of very slow economic growth. An era that saw virtually zero net new job creation. An era that saw an erosion of the immense socioeconomic gains that South Africa had recorded in its first decade as a democracy, which started, of course, with Mr. Mandela's election in 1994. And that what you're in fact seeing is the splintering of one of Africa's grandest liberation movements under socioeconomic pressure. And after a decade that's seen its most capable and astute leaders depart, sometimes for the business community, sometimes for retirement, sometimes to other political options.
Do you see the ANC going back to having negotiations with the Nkonto Wesizwe party in any government formation structure? Since looking at the polls recently, it looks like the ANC might not pull off the at least 50% of the total vote cast parliamentary to decide who becomes the next president?
Look, as I read it at the moment, and I sometimes have some insight into these things, is that none of the leaders of any of the major political organizations, except for some fringe extremist leaders, have yet made firm decisions on the coalition deals they might or might not strike, depending on the result that's delivered in the 29th of May election. And part of the reason for that is that we've lived in South Africa through 30 years of complete ANC dominance. And it's come for some people so very suddenly to see its collapse, and now the acceleration of that collapse under as a consequence of the new party started by Mr. Zuma. that the senior leaders of major political parties are a bit stunned by what they're observing, and they're not sure what alliances to strike and what the advantages might be one way or another. So I'd say to you that it's plausible at this stage that Mr. Zuma finds his way back to his erstwhile political home in the ANC, and that could happen. But the lean at the moment, and it's only that, there's nothing certain in this at all yet. It can all change over the next several weeks. The lean at the moment might be that the ANC finds itself in some governing formation with the official opposition of the past 30 years, which is a very much more liberal, you might say, in the classic sense, political formation, born out of the former small white opposition to apartheid. That party has grown very quickly into South Africa's middle classes, which are now to quite a significant extent racially integrated. And certainly, I think the preference in the local investment community here and amongst Western diplomats, as far as I can determine, the idea of a deal between the African National Congress and the former Liberal opposition, now challenging for power in its own right, key parts of the country. That transaction is where some talks seem to be leaning, but it is very much too early to suggest that that's going to be the final deal that's struck.
Franz Kronje is a political analyst and the chairman of the Social Research Foundation. He spoke with me from the South African capital, Pretoria. In Kenya, a security expert is expressing concern about political decisions behind the acquisition of military equipment. Major General retired Charles Mwanzia, formerly of the Kenya Defense Forces, or KFD, says decision made to purchase military equipment for all branches of the army should be left to experts in the military, backed by civilian leadership. His remarks come following the launch of an investigation into the helicopter crash that left the chief of the army and 8 others dead. President William Ruto has declared a 3-day mourning period in what he says was a tragic moment. For more analysis and the way forward, I reached Major General Charles Mwanzia in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
It is very, very unfortunate that we have ended up in the Kenya Air Force with a fleet of helicopters whose procurement was somehow influenced by, some political decisions rather than professional decisions as to what was best for the Kenya Air Force. And I'll give an example. We relied on a Puma helicopter, the Puma 330, a 2-engine transport helicopter, which was very, very reliable. A decision was made to move to a Russian Mi-17 transport helicopter whose reliability cannot match the Puma helicopter. The Kenya Air Force, I'm very, very well informed. I know that they wanted the Super Puma. Super Puma is the more advanced French transport aircraft with a sort of same engine, the Thermofossi, for those who know the aeroplanes, the type of an engine of the aircraft. Now, when they moved to Mi-17, the reliability of the Mi-17 is very, very questionable.
With this latest accident that claimed the lives of the Army General and some others, do you see an investigation and measures implemented to resolve this from recurring?
I'm sure, the Kenya Air Force has appointed a board of inquiry, which is led by the base commander, Laikipia Air Base, one of our brigadiers, a very capable pilot, to come up with the causes, what caused the accident, and recommendations of the measures to be taken to avoid recurrence of the same aircraft accident. But I would blame this accident on a very aged aircraft, I cannot blame the Kenya Air Force for the training, the professionalism of the pilots, the technical, the maintenance crew are extremely professional, well trained, and all of them trained locally in Kenya, United States of America, and France, highly capable in professionals. But when there are decisions which end up with equipment which is doubtful in terms of safety and security, this brings a lot of questions in the when it comes to the operation of equipment.
So basically, you are talking about the issues of politics, which you think should not be considered. Rather, professionals should be allowed to handle it instead of politically infused decisions. Is that what you are saying?
Peter, that's exactly what I'm saying. The professionals, these are the pilots and the technical staff, the military personnel should be let to identify the most suited equipment and be supported on their recommendations of what they need without any political interference.
So where does the Kenya military, and in this case, the Air Force, go from here following this incident and previous incidents that have happened that have also claimed their lives and injured many?
Yes, Peter, at the moment, we have a government which came into power 2022, is hardly 2 years. What we are seeing now are decisions from the previous regimes, not the current regime, which interfered in terms of identification of the equipment. I hope the current regime will be able to give support to the professionals who are in the offices and in command at the moment to be able to identify equipment and be supported and financed to be able to carry out their duties. And there's been a clear indication that this is the new regime, this is what they are doing now.
Major General Charles Mwanzi is a security expert. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Ethiopia is facing one of the worst droughts in recent history as millions of its people suffer from acute hunger. Ethiopia also faces a number of conflicts. According to humanitarian agencies, the two-year conflict in the northern Tigray region, which ended with a peace deal in November 2022, left most of the region's population of 6 million relying on humanitarian help. This week, the international community pledged millions of dollars in humanitarian assistance to address urgent needs resulting from conflict, insecurity, and climate shocks. Political analyst David Monda tells viewers Douglas Impuga he thinks the conflict and the humanitarian crisis are feeding off each other.
So Ethiopia is a very complex case, somewhat similar to Sudan in the sense that Ethiopia is made of so many different ethnic groups. It's one of the largest countries on the continent of Africa. But the problem with Ethiopia has been the government in Addis Ababa has used food as a weapon of war. So food has been leveraged to reward regions that have been supportive of the government, but also to punish those regions that are perceived to be anti-government. So that's one angle of it. So donors have been cutting down food aid because the food was being stolen and sold off to starving people. But I think, lastly, the other challenge is also that in relation to the humanitarian crisis, there's a dilemma for humanitarian assistance. Because a lot of times, particularly with displaced populations, with starving people, when the aid convoys come in, it's usually the armed groups that grab the food and use it as leverage against the starving population. So the food never reaches the people. So it's a big dilemma even for humanitarian organizations how to intervene. Because sometimes when you intervene with food aid that never gets to the people, you're actually feeding the armies, which is actually making the problem bigger. So Ethiopia is also in its own difficult dilemma and crisis.
As the hunger crisis unfolds in Ethiopia, so too has the the instability in the country. How do those two contribute to the suffering of the people?
They contribute significantly. One is the internal conflict. They feed off of each other. So the internal conflict, the civil war between, for example, the Tigray region and the central government, but also let's not forget the Oromia region in the south and the Ogaden region, which is majority Somali, is also in conflict with the central government. So there's these regional tensions with Addis Ababa and the regions that interplay with the humanitarian challenges, because as long as the civil war and the government is not willing to negotiate because it's afraid that if it negotiates with Tigray and Tigray becomes its own country, then the Ogaden region will want to break off and become part of Somalia, and then Oromia might want to break off and become its own country. So central government does not want to negotiate. But because the central government doesn't want to negotiate, it pushes on with the war, which then escalates a very difficult, an already difficult humanitarian crisis. So these two issues of the civil war and the humanitarian crisis, they feed off of each other. And it's very difficult to sort one without, you know, sorting out the other. So you have to stop the guns from going off, the fighting to stop for the humanitarian crisis to be reduced. But you can't reduce a humanitarian crisis without stopping the fighting. So it's one of those very difficult dilemmas that the central government in Addis is facing. And then lastly, I must add, Ethiopia has never had a tradition of peaceful transfer of power. I think that's another dynamic we also need to remember. We had our Emperor Haile Selassie, which is not a democratic system. He is a monarch. After that, you have a very repressive communist government, the Derg, under Mengistu. And then you've had repeated wars, you know, an internal conflict that have brought players to power to take over power. So not having that tradition of peaceful handover of power is very difficult, because whoever's supposed to replace Abiy or tries to replace Abiy would have to do it through the barrel of a gun rather than through a democratic process.
Internal struggles and conflicts aside, there's a feud with Somalia about the port access to the port.
Correct. And this one has both economic, strategic, and historical consequences. So Ethiopia is trying to negotiate a deal with Somaliland, which is a region in Somalia, to try and get an alternate access to Djibouti as a port through Somaliland instead of Ethiopia relying on Djibouti. So that's one economic angle. But strategically, Somalia doesn't want Ethiopia to have access to Somaliland because it's afraid that Ethiopia will be intervening in its own internal affairs in Somalia. And then thirdly, there's also the historical question. Central government in Mogadishu does not want Ethiopia engaging with any regions of Somalia without the authority of the government in Mogadishu, of course, because of the historical rivalry and the wars they've actually fought between Ethiopia and Somalia. So for those range of reasons, Mogadishu and Addis, I think, will continue to be at loggerheads. It's a really volatile situation in that region at this time.
David Monda is a professor of political science at City University of New York. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from New York. A U.S.-based NGO has been providing needed medical care and humanitarian assistance to residents in one of the conflict areas in Cameroon. Groups of separatists have been fighting the government in the mostly English-speaking parts of the country for the past 6 years. They are seeking to form an independent country to be called Ambazonia. Since the conflict began, many residents in the conflict zones have not been able to receive medical attention or the young ones to go to school. In response to the situation, the Lebang Cultural and Development Organization, or Likurdu USA, launched a free medical campaign 3 years ago in Libialem in Cameroon's southwest region to provide medical help and other social needs of the citizens. Representatives say U.S. medical professionals have been volunteering for the last 3 years to provide medical assistance to the citizens. Last month, over 600 patients received medical treatment. For more about the organization and its future plans, I reach Terence Atem. He is the leader of the Lebang Cultural and Development Organization, or Likurdu USA.
So For the past 3 years, we have organized a health campaign, under our American mission. You know, we mobilize volunteers from the United States and from Cameroon and these are medical practitioners. For the past 3 years, we've organized this health campaign in Fontaine and treated thousands of Cameroonians. And for the first year, we treated about 2,000, and that number increased progressively. And this year, we're able to take this effort to 3 different locations in Fontaine, in Alor subdivision, and in Chang. And the setting in Chang allowed those IDPs from around the country who could not go down to the war, you know, to the insecure area of Fontaine, to be able to come to Chang and receive 100% care.
Is this medical and social intervention from this NGO that you lead, will this continue?
I think the short answer is yes. But Peter, we haven't just stopped at healthcare. We're also constructing roads in that region. We also help to create schools. 3 years ago, there were no schools in that entire region. Over 49 schools have been destroyed as a result of the war, including colleges. And we started this initiative to begin to provide opportunities for many of the kids who some of them had stayed for 6 years without going to school. And you can imagine what that means. So a child who was born when this crisis started 3 years ago when we engaged in this program had not been to school. So elementary education was missing. So we came in and we started with a single school. And today we are proud and happy for the sake of these innocent children that today we have 12 schools that are operating thanks to Likudu United States.
The areas that you visit are often prone to attacks by the Amber Boys or the separatists, as the government described them. How were you able to ease fears of some of these volunteers who went with you and are providing this much needed assistance?
That's a good question. And it's a very complicated situation, as we all know, in a conflict zone, because we're a non-profit, a charitable group, just like the Red Cross. We really, really try to engage all our local communities, because at the end of the day, you know, they know who is there and they can talk to them. And it's truly, honestly, it's been a challenge to really alleviate that fear of insecurity in the minds of all our volunteers. And that's why we had then to set up one of the health campaigns outside of the war zone. These are big professionals. You can imagine we have in our team the neurosurgeon who operated on John McCain's brain when he had the cancer of the brain. So we provide that option also, that if somebody is not very convinced and doesn't feel safe to go down to that war zone, then there is this option in Chang, which is right a border city to our target area, where we organize a health campaign for IDPs, those who cannot gain services directly from the war zone where we operate. So it's been a very complicated and very, very challenging. I think at the end of the day, it's trust, where the military, the Amber Boys, do not see us as a threat. They basically see us as the Red Cross coming to provide vital services to people in need.
Terence Atem is the leader of Likudu USA. He spoke with me from here in Washington. Right now, it's time for music from African Collection.
Na shati tu Kuzirudi kibongongo mbaga chinyali do chido, do chido, do chido, do abebi do chido, do chido, boya do. Che, yeni do chido, do chido, do chido, do abebi do chido, do chido, boya do. When you hear the sound, sound cool.
That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Impuga and engineer Tiang Wang, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a diplomat should be yielding and supple as a creeper that can be bent but not broken. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Money, I don't go, if you get your money, I give you, and you give me.